Good morning. There is a good spirit in the church today. I think you came ready, prepared to worship. Maybe it's that extra hour of sleep that you got. Maybe that helped. That just means I get an extra hour to preach today. That's what I read online anyway. It might take me that long, so I better jump into it. We are going to continue our series called Faithful, and during this series we're going through the book of Daniel, looking at Daniel's life, and specifically today, we're going to look at a story that you are probably familiar with. It's the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I think this is one story that if you were in church when you were younger as a child, this is one story that probably stood out to you, a story that I remember being covered in Sunday school. We would act it out. There would be, you know, different songs that go with it. And anytime I am led to preach a sermon from a passage that everyone knows, I always find that tougher than preaching maybe somewhere else. Because I think it's very easy for us to think, I already know this passage, so I'm going to tune this out because I know what he's going to say. He's going to say God's with us through the fire. I mean, that is what most preachings on this passage is going to focus on, and we're going to talk about that towards the end. But one of the great things about the Bible is that no matter how many times you read a passage, you can see something different each time. And this time is no different. I read through this, and one statement stood out to me that gave me the direction for us to go in today. So let's go and jump into it. We're going to be in Daniel chapter 3. We're taking it mostly verse by verse, and we're going to summarize the last little bit just for time's sake. Last week, if you've not been here for the last couple weeks, God's people has been taken captive into Babylon. They have a king named King Nebuchadnezzar that is not a very good king. He worships false gods. He had a dream last week in Daniel 2. God gave Daniel the ability to interpret that dream, and the dream had to do with what was going to happen in the future and along with the end times. We covered that last week. And at the end of that, King Nebuchadnezzar is like, your God is God, and he respects the God of Daniel. Well, something's changed because this is not the same King Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 3, which tells me there's probably some time that has passed. From Daniel 2 to Daniel 3. So let's look at verses. We're going to start with verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So this could be, you know, kind of what the picture looks like. We don't really know what the gold statue looks like, but it's a statue of gold, and this thing is humongous. If you're not familiar with what cubits means, let's just put it in American language, this was a 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide statue. This is a big statue. There is some debate on whether this statue was of King Nebuchadnezzar, or was it of a false god. They would worship a pantheon of gods, a bunch of different gods. Was it one of those gods that he made a statue of? We don't really know. It just said that King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold. That one of the commentaries I read said that it probably is of a false god, because if it was of King Nebuchadnezzar, then they would just worship King Nebuchadnezzar because he's there. They wouldn't have to worship this false image. Anyway, the point is, though, there is this ginormous statue that has been created. Interesting to me that the statue is gold, because if you remember the dream last week, Babylon was depicted as the gold head in that dream. Verses 2 and 3, he then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the advisors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before it. Rather than me going through what each one of these groups represent, I just want you to know that these are the leaders under King Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. These are leaders of the provinces. Think in terms of us, it'd be like mayors, governors, senators. These are the who's who of Babylon society. And he told them, hey, come. We're going to dedicate this image. We're going to dedicate this statue. I want you all here. Verses 4 through 6. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, nations and people of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. Now remember, Babylon has taken over the known world at this point. And so that's why they're able to say, nations and people of every language, because there's a mixture of nations that they have conquered and people from all over that have gathered here together. So the herald is announcing, hey, this is what you're commanded to do. Verse 5. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. Just for time's sake, I'm not going to go through what each one of these instruments are, but you can get the picture that this is almost like a full band. This is a full setup. These are different instruments that they have. It's a big affair. It's a big event. And when all of these instruments make this noise, the instruction is they are to fall down and worship that gold image, that statue that is set up. And obviously the statue is pretty tall, so they're probably going to be able to see it from a long distance away. And they should be able to hear, with all those different instruments, they should be able to hear the sound and know, hey, now is when we are to worship. I think the only thing that I could think of that maybe we can identify this with is, you know, some Muslim cities, they will play music when it's time for them to pray, because they pray at certain times during the day. And so you'll hear the music playing, and they turn and they pray and they bow down. That's the same sort of picture here. One thing I do want to note about this list of musical instruments, and this is kind of cool. We're going to see this list time and time again. I think it's three or four times here in Daniel 3. And each time we see this list, it is a sign that something important has happened or is going to happen. Each time we see this list, it serves as a transition from one part to the next part here in Daniel 3. So this is like a literary thing that Daniel put in for us to essentially for him to say, hey, pay attention, because here's something important happening. So with this first time that the instruments are listed, it's basically the command is given out. Here's what you are to do. Let's go to verse 7. Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of, here's the list again, the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations and peoples of every language fell down and worshiped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So there's the list again, and what has changed? We went from the command given out to now they're actually doing it. They're actually worshiping this image. Verse 8. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. So the astrologers, if you remember the last couple weeks, Daniel and his friend belonged to this group of wise men, of magi, this class of people within Babylon society. And so these are some of their own people, and they've come forward, and they're going after the Jews. They're going after the people of Judah and Israel that have been taken captive. Now, obviously, this is a targeted attack, and this is because of the Jews and their beliefs. Verse 9, they said to King Nebuchadnezzar, may the king live forever. Your majesty has issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipe, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold. There's that list. It's a clue something important's happening. Verse 11, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold that you have set up. So the list that is given is indicating to us something important is happening. What's happening right now is that these astrologers are pointing out that, hey, there's some people that's not listening to you, king. There's some people that are not falling down to worship the image of gold. And specifically, they're zeroing in on these three. These three are the same three that are listed in Daniel 1 and Daniel 2 as Daniel's friends. And each time that God came through for Daniel in the first two chapters, these three guys get promoted to be over more in Babylon as well. And so it says right there, they are over the affairs of the province of Babylon. So these are people that are higher up. And the astrologers are probably jealous. It's probably what's going on here. And doesn't understand why they are getting this special treatment where they're not having to bow down or, and I want to point this out, it's not just about worshiping this image. It says they neither serve your gods nor worship the image. So these astrologers are pointing out that, hey, these three are not going along with everything else that's going on here in Babylon. These three are not going along with your commands. They're not worshiping these other gods. They are doing their own thing, and you need to get them. Now, this should not bother Nebuchadnezzar because of what happened in Daniel 2. We already kind of hinted at that. Hey, in Daniel 2, at the end of that, he's respecting their God. Hey, surely God, the God of Daniel, is God. But yet, verse 13 says that King Nebuchadnezzar becomes furious with rage. That tells me something's happened between Daniel 2 and Daniel 3. It's one chapter for us. It might be 20, 30 years for them. I mean, it was a time frame that has passed. And so King Nebuchadnezzar is angry. And so he summons Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so these men were brought before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold that I have set up? Now when you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I have made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" The list that is given to us again, the important event that goes along with it is that this punishment is announced. Basically, this ultimatum. Either you fall down and worship, or you're getting thrown into a blazing furnace. Don't know what this blazing furnace looked like exactly. I kind of imagine like a huge cave-like thing that they're thrown into, almost like what potters put their pottery in, something, a big kiln-type thing. That's the image I have in my head. I don't know if that's exactly right. But he's saying, hey, you either fall down and worship this image, or you're getting thrown into the fire. But then he better be careful, because that last statement there, then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? He's equating himself with God. He's saying, what God is going to be able to rescue you from me? I'm the king. I'm powerful. What he's doing here is, once again, I think I've said this in every sermon so far, back in this time, it was the gods of these different countries versus other gods. It's setting up this battle between King Nebuchadnezzar and his false gods and the one true God, the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Man, what a stand that they take. They says, hey, we don't need to defend ourselves in front of you. And you're the king of Babylon, but we serve a greater king. We serve someone that's greater than you, and that is who we ultimately answer to. And so they say, we can't do this, and they can't worship this false image because of what was commanded of God's people in Exodus 20:3 through the first part of verse 5. It says, you shall have no other gods before me. Right now, King Nebuchadnezzar is trying to get them to have another god. And then this one. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. So what King Nebuchadnezzar is asking God's people to do is blatantly against what God has commanded them not to do. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are taking this stand in front of the king, which, number one, took a lot of courage for them to say, This is against what God has commanded us to do, and we don't answer to you. Ultimately, we answer to God. And so they say in verse 17, if we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. Now we look at that verse and we're like, great. That is a faith-filled verse. That's kind of the song we just sang. That's kind of the focus of it, that we know that God can do the impossible. We know that God can get us out of, can save us from any situation. We know that God is a great God. And this is, I think for us today, what they're saying there is equal to us praying that someone would experience healing, that they would be completely healed of their cancer, that they'd be completely healed of that disease, that they would turn completely around and turn to God, that the impossible would become possible, and God can do it. And so we read that verse and we're like, yes. And that's often where the sermons go when we look at this story, because it's encouraging that God can do the impossible. And spoiler alert, he does. He does this very thing that is, they state in verse 17. They get thrown into the furnace and God rescues them. Because God is that type of God. He can do the impossible. That would be what I would typically get up here and preach, an encouraging sermon that God is going to come through. If we have faith, we just have to be bold in our faith, etc., etc. But I think that verse 18 is where it's at. Can you put that back up, Zach? I think it's bold to pray that God would do the impossible. I think it's even more bold to say this. To say, but even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up. See, my sermon just did a flip, because we could have done a really encouraging one about how God can do the impossible, but instead what we're going to talk about today is how to keep our faith strong even when God doesn't come through. Because I think that is probably more helpful to us than for me to just to get you hyped up and send you out of here. And then let's say God doesn't come through for you and you're having a crisis of faith. They are saying that even if we are tortured in this fire, even if our skin begins to melt off of our bones, even if we get in that fire and we burn up, we want you to know, your majesty the king, that we are still not going to serve your gods or worship this image. That even if God does not come through, we still aren't doing what you want us to do, which would be disobedient to God. That's bold. That is true faith. That's the faith that we are called to have. That made me wonder if we have that type of faith. The statement, the line that we're going to be working with is this: the faith of, even if he does not, I still will. They say we still will because they're a group. But even if he does not, I still will. Are we going to say that even if he does not take this pain away, I still will worship him? Even if he does not heal my loved one, I still will be faithful. Even if he does not save their life, I'm still following him. Even if he does not lead me to a future spouse, I will still serve him. Even if he does not get me this job, he's still my God. Even if he does not, I still will. Let's be honest. This type of faith is really hard to develop. This type of faith is not the faith I think many of us start out with when we start our walk with God. It's a faith, I think it's hard because it's a faith that's counter to what we feel. When things are going good, we can pray that first part and pray that God would do the miraculous, that God will come through. And it's easy to follow God when things are going good. But when you feel like God hasn't come through for you, when you feel like God hasn't done what you thought he should do, that's when faith gets hard. Because you're not feeling it. But God still calls us to worship him. It's also countercultural. We live in a culture here in America and even in the church that everyone is there to serve us. You go to the grocery store, the workers are there to serve you. You go to a restaurant, they're there to serve you. And we can bring that mindset into our relationship with God and think that God is there to serve me. That God is supposed to come through for me. And there's even scriptures like talking about that God's a good father, that if you who are earthly fathers know how to give good gifts to your children, don't you know that God, who truly is good, knows how to give good gifts? So like we can look at those scriptures and we're like, man, God's a good God. He's going to give me what I need. He's going to give me what I want. He's going to come through for me. And that's kind of been set up in our Christian culture. That's been set up in the culture around us, but it has made its way into the church. I call it consumerism, where we are there to consume what God wants to do for us. But what happens when God doesn't do what we think he should? I've dealt with enough customers at Food Lion where I didn't do what they thought I should, and they let me have it. But I did what my overlords told me to do. Not all of them. And so we have to develop this type of faith when it's counter to what we feel and what the world is around us. And it's a faith that I think takes time to develop, and I think we can look at the life of the disciples and see the time that it took for them to develop this type of faith. I know they didn't have this type of faith because they disappeared when Jesus went to the cross. But while things were going good, while he was doing miracles, while he was doing the impossible, they're right there with him. But when he says, hey, I got to go die. When he was being tortured, when he was hanging on the cross, many of them were gone. Peter himself denied Jesus 3 times. He was fine with Jesus until Jesus did not do what he thought he should do as the Messiah. They did not have this type of faith. Yet, all the disciples, with the exception of John, although you could include John in this as well, die for their faith. And so all of them have developed this type of faith where even if he does not save me from this execution, I still will. They all get executed because they still did. So they developed that faith, but it didn't happen overnight. I think it happened over multiple struggles that they have went through for them to develop that faith by the end of their lives. And so for us, I want us to understand, you don't develop this faith overnight. It takes time. And so my question for you, and it's going to be the same statement, but I'm going to put a blank there. My question for you is, do you have this faith? The faith of even if he does not blank. I don't know what your blank is. You still will. Here's what I want to call this faith. I want to call it, and this is the title of today's sermon, is Forging Anti-Fragile Faith. And I already showed you 1 point, but Forging Anti-Fragile Faith. And yes, anti-fragile is a word. I looked it up. ChatGPT confirmed it for me. But I specifically worded it this way because I think that an anti-fragile faith, a faith that does not break when the going gets tough, a faith that does not break in the storms, is only forged in the fire. Just as metal is put into a fire to be purified and to be warped and to be made into what it needs to be made, I think that is what happens with our faith. So let's talk about three keys to forging anti-fragile faith that we're going to learn from Daniel's three friends. First, we need to remember what God has done. And I think that Daniel's three friends are already there, because they are displaying this amazing faith. First, they start with the faith-filled statement of, God can save us from this. And the reason why they can say that is because God's already done it for them twice in Daniel 1 and 2, and he's probably done it for them more than that. But in Daniel 1 and 2, he saves them from King Nebuchadnezzar the first time, from having to eat this food that was sacrificed to idols, most likely. And then second time, they are included in this group that's going to be put to death unless someone can tell King Nebuchadnezzar what he dreamed and interpret it. And Daniel goes to his three friends and says, pray that God will show us mercy, that God will give me the vision of what he dreamed, and God did. And so they've already seen God come through twice when they probably should have been killed both times because they were being disobedient to the king. And so they have this faith of, yes, God can do it, God has done it. But I think when we remember what God has done, it also helps us develop this faith of, even if he does not. Because I think we all know just how unworthy and undeserving we are of God's love and mercy and grace. And so, for them, they were like, man, I'm like a cat. I got 9 lives and I've already used 2 of them. They're like, God's already come through for me 2 times when he probably shouldn't have. Because I know what a bad person I am. And so I think they've developed this humility that, hey, God's good. God can do this if he wants to, but even if he does not, it's going to be okay. Because I'm already living longer than I should have. I already have more than I should have. I've already been blessed more than I could have ever asked for or imagined. He's given it to me. And so even if he does not, it doesn't change the fact that I still will worship him because he is a good God. I think we have to remember what God has done. And there's 2 places we can look. We can look in the Bible, the times where he's came through for people, the times where he has done amazing and powerful things. But you know, the Bible also contains stories where times in his sovereignty that he didn't come through. He didn't come through for Jesus rescuing him from the cross. He didn't take this cup away from Jesus as Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane. And aren't you thankful that he didn't? I thought about Stephen, a young man who's a follower of Jesus, being stoned to death. He didn't. God didn't save him from that. Yet, Stephen's death sparked the church to get out of Jerusalem and spread the gospel to other places. That was in God's sovereignty. We can look back and say, if Stephen didn't die, the gospel would not have spread as quickly outside of that one area. And so God didn't come through, and yet I think we can look back and say we're thankful because there's more people who got saved through that. You probably can look in your life. Times where he didn't come through for you in the past when you prayed that God would fix that relationship with that girl you liked, and he didn't, thank God. Being thankful for or amazed that God has come through for you in the past. You know, like that you're thankful for the ways that he has come through. It helps your love for him to grow, and it pushes our faith to become even more anti-fragile because you realize just how good your God's been to you. I think I can look back in my life, and I can see the times that God has come through for me, and that has strengthened my faith, and I know that God has been good to me in more ways than I could ever ask for or deserve. And so that has developed within me that even if he does not, I still will worship him because he's been better to me than I ever have been to him. But there's also been times in my life where he didn't come through. And one time in particular that I can think of was in my first pastorate, my first job as a pastor. It only lasted a few months. I was 20, 21 years old. I was hoping I would be able to continue there and pastor, but it didn't work out. And back then, I looked at it as God didn't come through. But boy, am I thankful that he didn't, because we wouldn't be here today. This would not be here, because I would have still been down there probably. And so I'm glad, looking back, that he didn't. And so it trusts me that even if he doesn't now, he still has a plan. I just have to remain faithful. That in particular helped me develop that type of faith. So I can think of both the times he's come through and the times he didn't that have helped me grow a more anti-fragile faith. And you probably can too. You're probably thinking of those times as well. The second key that I see in this passage is that you need to have the right people around you. I wonder, would Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego individually had been as bold as they were if they didn't have the other two to take this stand with them? You know, we don't know, so we're speculating here. But one thing I do know is that it's easier to take a stand when you have the right people around you. That it's easier to go through the fire when you have people that walk through the fire with you. And so I think that this is playing a role here. They feel like they can be bold because they have one another. And so you probably can look back in your life and see times in which having the right people around you helped keep you on track. Helped keep you, how many times have maybe you've been faced with a similar, maybe not like this, where fall down and worship this image or die, but you've been faced with this decision to make, and you sought counsel from those around you that helped keep you on the right track. And even though what you may have been asked to do is hard, these people say, I'm still going to be with you. I'm going to walk with you no matter what. I can look at countless times in my life where I can say that. Specifically, I would say around 2019. I look back now, and I realize that I was struggling with major depression around that time. I remember sitting on the beach just crying my eyes out just because I was so down, so depressed. I didn't realize until I've gotten out of it now how bad of a shape I was in then. And I'm not sure I would have made it through it as well as I did if I didn't have the right people around me. If I didn't have my wife, if I didn't have my friends, if I didn't have the church, people that were able to speak into my life and check in on me, I'm not sure I would have made it through it. And you're going to hear another time later on where having the right people around me helped. And so my question for you today is, do you have the right people around you? Because the fires of life are going to come. Do you have people who are going to take a stand with you in the fire if that's what it takes? Or are those people going to flee when the going gets tough? Ecclesiastes 4, 9 through 10 and verse 12 says, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. Verse 12, though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves, and a cord of three strands is not quickly broken. That's the wisdom book, wisdom from King Solomon. He's saying, hey, there's power in numbers. So if you have other people that are going to be with you, that cord of three strands is not going to be quickly broken. You need other people with you so that when the storms come that are supposed to shatter your faith has other people to help hold it together. In fact, the author of Hebrews says this in Hebrews 10, 24 through 25. Let us consider how we may spur one another on towards love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day, and the day is capitalized because he's talking about the day of Jesus' return, the end of this age, because you see the day approaching. We're going through end times on Monday night in our young adults group. And one of the things we talked about is the tribulation period is going to be tough. And if I know some people believe the church is going to be raptured out beforehand. If we're not, you better have an anti-fragile faith, or it is going to shatter in the face of the Antichrist. You better have a faith that has been forged in the fire. And that's what I think the author of Hebrews is hinting at here. He's saying you need to be around one another even more as you see that day approaching, because you're going to need people to help you hold it together. So I think these first two are kind of helping us prepare for the storm that is to come, for the fire that is to come, remembering what God has done, remembering how good God has been to us, remembering when God didn't come through the way we wanted him to, yet he was still good. We can look back and see that he was working things for our good. Have the right people around you so that when those times come, you can be strong in your faith. This is what the church should be for one another. We should encourage one another. We should stand in the fire with one another. This third one, though, is specifically for when you're in the fire. And I debated on what point I was going to put up here, but I'm going to put this one. You need to seek the presence of God. Because let's be honest. You're not going to have an anti-fragile faith without God. You can be prepared all you want to stand up in the face of people who are saying die or renounce your faith. You can prepare your mind, you can prepare your heart all you want. But without God's power at work in our life, it's just not possible. And I think we don't see in this passage here that they specifically sought God, but I got to think they prayed. God told them, don't cave to what King Nebuchadnezzar is telling you to do. I'm going to be with you. And even if they didn't, I think they knew that God was near, because they have this remarkable peace of saying, God can come through for us, but even if he doesn't, I'm still worshiping him. That is remarkable peace that I think only comes through the presence of God. So let's continue on in the passage, verses 19 through 23. Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude towards them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual. This is interesting, because if old Nebuchadnezzar was thinking, he would realize that the hotter the furnace, the less torture they would endure, because they would die quicker. So he wasn't thinking at this. He just was thinking out of anger. He commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, their trousers, their turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace was so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. So the soldiers died, and some of their strongest soldiers. So this actually hurt Nebuchadnezzar and his army, because some of his best soldiers die out of his anger of throwing these three guys into the fire. But at this point, they're in the fire. In verses 24 through 25 is the climax of this passage. King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement, and he asked his advisors, weren't there three men that were tied up and thrown into this fire? And they replied, certainly, your majesty. And he said, well, look, I see four. I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed. And the fourth looks like a son of the gods. Who was this fourth one? There's great debate on, was it an angel of the Lord? Or was it Jesus himself? Was it the presence of God? We don't know. I don't know if it matters. What matters is it was God. I think traditionally it's been viewed as Jesus, because there's so many similarities to what happens here to what happens when Jesus comes and rescues us all from our sins. He unbinds us from sin. He unbounds us from being chained to sin, and he sets us free. And so these guys, the three that were thrown in there, they are unbound, they are unharmed, and there's a fourth guy present. Now, Nebuchadnezzar is amazed, as I think we all would be. But I wonder what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are feeling and thinking right now. They're in this fire, probably not even feeling that it's hot. And they're not getting hurt, and they see a fourth person there. You know that they are coming out of this fiery trial stronger than ever before. Their faith, they are literally in a fire, and their faith is being forged to become more anti-fragile. They're literally living out Isaiah 43:2, when God says, when you walk through the fire, you will not be burned, and the flames will not set you ablaze. Don't you know that they are coming out of that fire just so pumped up, you know? Like, hey, God is with us. I'm sure that they are amazed. I'm sure their faith has just grown exponentially because God is present in the fire. Not only that, to summarize the rest of the chapter, the king orders them to come out. They come out. Verse 27 says that they saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Nebuchadnezzar is amazed at God's work in their life, and he issues this decree in verse 29. It says, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything about the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they are to be cut into pieces, and their houses are to be turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save this way. So once again, he's respecting the God of Daniel. Where is Daniel, by the way? We don't know. We don't know if Daniel's present. We don't know if Daniel is there. I don't think Daniel bowed down to worship this image. I think that Daniel probably didn't have to because he's so high up within the king's court. That's my take. But they ended up promoted once again in Babylon. So not only did they make it through the fire, not only did they literally witness a miracle, live through a miracle, but now they are promoted even higher in Babylon. God has come through for them in amazing ways. Talk about a fire that forges anti-fragile faith. With us, I think we spend so much time asking God to keep us out of the fire. Well, sometimes God wants us to go through the fire so that we know that he is in the fire. We would rather not go through the struggles of life, we'd rather not face times in which our faith could shatter. But here's what Peter says in 1 Peter, Zach, don't have this for the screen because I added it later. In 1 Peter 1:6-7, Peter said, be truly glad. There's wonderful joy ahead, even for those who must endure many trials for a little while. These trials will show that your faith is genuine. It is being tested as fire tests and purifies gold. So not only does the fire test you, but it purifies you. Though your faith is far more precious than mere gold. So when your faith remains strong through many trials, aka when your faith is anti-fragile, when it's being forged to be stronger, it will bring you much praise and glory and honor on the day when Jesus Christ is revealed to the whole world. See, when we go through the trials in life, the fires in life, we find out that he is near to us. If we are seeking and open to his presence. We're getting ready to enter Christmas season, and one of the titles of Jesus is he's the Prince of Peace. The Bible talks about this peace that's beyond all understanding that can only come from God. Is that not the peace that we see them living out? You cannot have anti-fragile faith without God's presence at work in your life to give you that peace that even if he does not, I still will. The most fragile my faith has ever been was when we had a miscarriage a few years ago. I, of course, had remembered how God has come through for me in the past, and that helped me get through that time period. I had the right people around me. I had good people around me to help me through. But, man, I feel like God didn't come through for us. I remember being on the floor in our living room praying on the couch that God would save this baby. And I came out of that, I was praying very much like that first statement of, you know, God, you can. I specifically remember thinking that there's that scripture that says, if your father knows how to give good gifts, how much more does our God know how to give good gifts? And so I was praying that scripture. I was begging God to come through. And when we found out that we had lost that baby, it's like someone took a hammer to my faith. And I don't think I realized how damaging it was to my faith until now that I'm still working through healing from that. And having to convince myself that God is a good God. I know he is, but I don't always feel it right here. And I wouldn't have gotten through that with the faith that I still have. Was my faith damaged? Yeah. You could argue that it was being hammered away, the parts that shouldn't be there, and it's going to be forged into something stronger. I wouldn't have gotten through that if I didn't remember how God has come through for people in the Bible, how God has come through for me in the past without the right people in my life. And ultimately, I just had to keep seeking his presence. In the middle of it, I remember being so mad at God and just telling him that I was so mad at him that I didn't understand. I thought you were supposed to be a good God, and you allowed this to happen. And you know what? God was okay with me being that blunt with him. God was okay with that because he already knew what I was feeling, and I was just getting it out and dealing with it with him. And ultimately, like I said, I'm still growing through this. I'm still healing from that, and my faith is still being forged through that fire. But I have, here in the last few weeks even, just through God speaking to me, have felt his presence in ways connected to that, in ways that are almost unexplainable. I really can't explain it. But I can sense within me that God is developing this faith of even if he does not. For me, it's even if he does not save this baby, I still will. I still did, even though I didn't want to. But through that and through his continued presence and love that I feel in my life, I know that I'm developing this faith that even when the tough times come in the future, even if he does not do what I think he should do, I still will. As the worship team comes up, you have a note card located in the seat in front of you. I want you to take that note card out. And on that note card, I want you to write, even if he does not. And I want you to fill in the blank for you today. What is the blank for you today? Even if he does not save my loved one, even if he does not take away this pain, even if he does not lead me to a future spouse, even if he does not give me this job, even if he does not, I still will. So I want you to take some time right now. I want you to write down, what is that, even if he does not? And we're going to sing one last song. We sang it for the first time last week, and it's called Another in the Fire. And what I'm going to invite you to do, you can be as blunt as you want to be on that card, because we're not going to take these cards. You're going to keep these cards, and you're going to pray over this week. But what I'm going to invite you to do during this last song is to seek his presence. That even if he does not, whatever storm you're going through, maybe you're thinking of something that's happened in the past, even if he does not, I'm still healing from the miscarriage. Even if he did not save my baby, I still will. And of course, you know, I know he did. Someone said to me, said, your baby is not wherever you think that baby, that body is. That baby's in heaven with God. And that hit me like a ton of bricks and helped forge my faith into stronger. So what is it for you today? What is the blank? We're getting ready to sing this song, and I'm going to invite you to come and pray at the altar. Seek his presence. Help him forge, pray that he would forge that faith within you so that you can stand when the trials of life come. Let's pray.